I'm delighted to acknowledge the presence of Ann Wimpfheimer, Yoni Boxer, and Benjamin Boxer. Ann will be speaking a little bit. Professor Baruch Boxer was a beloved teacher and colleague in JTS's Talmud department before succumbing to cancer at a tragically young age. He wrote numerous important books and articles, but he's probably best known for The Origins of the Seder, recently reissued by JTS Press, and of particular relevance at this time of year as we prepare for Pesach. Rabbi Ben Sion Boxer was the beloved rabbi of the Forest Hills Jewish Center for many years. He was also a scholar and published several important books on rabbinic texts and ancient Jewish history. And please, Ann.
I don't want to reiterate what Richard has said, but I want to thank everybody for coming here today on this not quite as bad a day as yesterday, but certainly a little bit inclement weather. I want to thank the Finkelstein Institute for co-sponsoring this lecture with us. This lecture is a slightly different format than the academic talks that we've sponsored over the past, I think it's 20 years, where we've had pretty much a scholarly, a public talk and two scholarly talks with the seminary community. This talk specifically was as a centers on issues related to ethics, and both my late father-in-law, Rabbi Ben Sion Boxer, and my late husband, Rabbi Baruch Boxer, both, in addition to their academic areas of interest, were greatly committed to social justice and ethics. And in that vein, we had today's talk takes that into account. I also want to acknowledge that this is the first talk that we've had since the death of my mother-in-law, Kalia Boxer, and she was extremely instrumental in this series happening. I think last year was the first one she was unable to attend, but we think of her today because she certainly embodied ethical values and action, and her own life was a great proponent of working for social justice. And in some ways, I feel like at today's talk in some ways dedicated to her, as well as her son and her late son and late husband. So I want to thank Professor Dr. Middleman and Professor Dr. Kelman for their amazing amount of hard work that went into the organization of this today's program. It's a slightly different format, and it took a tremendous amount of work. I also want Bobby Raphael, the assistant. Everybody worked very hard. And so I want to thank them. I want to thank everybody who came today, and I also want to acknowledge and thank my sons for being here, whose lives also embody the spirits of their grandfather, their grandmother, and their father. So thank you very much, and we look forward to hearing and learning together. And just one note, at the end of our talk here today, we're going to hear from a student about some of the ways in which this is not going to just be words, but in reality there will be action that will be coming forth from what we're going to study today. And my hope and our hope in today's talk was that it wouldn't just be an academic talk, but actually the ethics in which we can live our lives and be inspired by that. So we're going to hear that at the end of the thing, and people can talk about ways in which we can change our daily lives by what we learned today. Thank you.
So the format of today's session is that we're going to start off with with our main speaker, Professor Noam Zohar. Professor Zohar was among the founding students of the Shalom Hartman Institute and was ordained there in 1990. He earned his BA and master's degree at the Hebrew University in Jewish Thought and his PhD in philosophy also at Hebrew U in 1991. Noam Zohar is a member of the Department of Philosophy at Bar-Ilan University and director of its graduate program in bioethics, and a member of the Department of Jewish Philosophy. He teaches rabbinics, philosophy of halakha, and moral and political philosophy, with an emphasis on applied ethics and particularly bioethics. He has served on various committees and national commissions, advising on issues of ethics and justice in healthcare, and has been involved in revising the IDF Code of Conduct. We're also going to have a text study, and our the That will be facilitated and led by Rabbi Nina Beth Carden and Professor Eliezer Diamond. Rabbi Carden is founder and director of the Baltimore Jewish Environmental Network. At the Pearlstone Conference and Retreat Center, an environmental activist, educator, and also an author. She serves as a member of the One Maryland Vision Task Force, a state think tank dedicated to developing a sustainability vision for the state of Maryland, and she also serves as a community outreach representative on the Baltimore County Sustainability Network. She most recently served as general consultant to the Coalition on the Environment and Jewish Life. And Professor Eliezer Diamond is a Rabbi Judah Nadish Associate Professor of Talmud and Rabbinics at the Jewish Theological Seminary. Dr. Diamond is the author of many popular and scholarly articles, including a forthcoming review of articles in the second edition of Encyclopedia Judaica dealing with rabbinic texts. It will appear in the periodical Judaica Librarianship. He is the author of Holy Men and Hunger Artists, Fasting and Asceticism in Rabbinic Culture, published by Oxford University Press, and it's a great read. Dr. Diamond is currently editing a commentary on Yerushalmi Psachim, written by the late Professor Louis Ginsberg, as well as a book on prayer. So anyway, without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce the first of our speakers, Professor Zohar.
Well, hello. It's an honor to be here today, and especially in the context of remembering Rabbi Boxer. And I should say that it's not only that they were, I didn't know them personally, but from reading and hearing about them, I think that it's not only that they were interested in, of course, in Jewish scholarship and also in social justice, but in finding the connection between the two. That is a way in which our Jewish heritage and learning can inspire and give guidance to our concerns about the real life and the society. And it's in that spirit that I will wish to share with you some thoughts and explorations this afternoon, together with Nina and Eliezer, we've worked on building this study session and the sequence that we'll go through. Now, I want to begin, actually, with a rather well-known biblical commentator who lived in the late 17th century in England, and his name was John Locke. Now, it may seem strange that I'm saying Locke was a biblical commentator, but if you're familiar with Locke's writings, they're filled with biblical references building on the Bible, speaking about the rights given to people by God, and including the text that we'll look at as a point of departure. Now, of course, Locke is important not mainly as a biblical commentator, but as one might say the founding father and the leading spirit in the political and moral ideology of personal freedom. He emphasized that everyone is born free, and this is the political philosophy that he formulated, especially in his Second Treatise on Government, from which these texts are taken. And he actually had to leave England for a while because it became dangerous. It was the restoration of the Catholic-leaning government, monarchy, actually, and his positions as those of his champion Lord Shaftesbury became dangerous to maintain, and he had to flee to the Netherlands for a while. And then they had the Glorious Revolution, and he was, as the English call it, glorious because it was without bloodshed. That's how the reason they give. Restoring the constitutional monarchy or proto-democracy or whatever you want to call the regime that they then and now have, actually, across the Atlantic. And Locke's writings were significant sources of inspiration for the founding fathers of this country. And his ideas about personal freedom, a property, pursuit of happiness in the sense of flourishing, central to, if you read the Federalist Papers or the writings of the Founding Fathers, they were really his students and followers about 100 years later than his writings. Now, that's important for our topic today because the capitalist ideology and the libertarian ideology that says everyone is entitled to his or her freedom, and as long as you don't harm someone else, that's the correction emphasized by Mill many years later, but that's really implicit already in Locke's work, live and let live. And of course, there's something very appealing and beautiful and valuable about that, if you contrast it to centuries of tyranny. And the idea of personal freedom, of respecting other people's freedom to do their own thing, to live their own life, to flourish, to also to accumulate wealth through their enterprise and ingenuity and investment of effort. And there's Locke's theory of ownership, which we'll look at in a moment. That is very important as a backdrop, of course, to our discussion these days about taking too much, taking from the world, taking from others. Let's, without further ado, have a glimpse at Locke. Now, I have here three passages that you see in the first page of this handout. This I didn't have to translate. The Talmudic texts and some of the medieval ones, I did a special translation for today, but this is in the original English. For my Israeli students, this is often more difficult. You know, they read things in contemporary English, they get used to that. Then they have to read 17th century English, and they're somewhat bewildered. But it's not as bad as Shakespeare, not by half. Now, Locke talked about how people become owners of things by mixing their labor with the things. So one of his examples is acorns. You may imagine people in a forest, and they go foraging for acorns. And I collect the 113 acorns, and they're mine, because I worked on that. And if you want acorns, go and collect your own pile. And then he moves from those things to ownership in the earth itself. Of course, this is still a mainly agricultural society, and the main means of production, as Marx would say, is the earth, the land itself. And he says the chief matter of property being now not the fruits of the earth and the beasts that subsist on it, but the earth itself. I think I skip a few words. It is plain that property is in that too is acquired as the former. As much land as a man tills, plants, improves, cultivates, and can use the product of, so much is his property. He, by his labor, does, as it were, enclose it from the common. Nor will it invalidate his right to say everybody else has an equal title to it, and therefore he cannot appropriate, he cannot enclose, without the consent of all his fellow commoners. Okay? So his vision is that God gave the world, and he says that explicitly, to everyone, to all of mankind. So then the counter-argument against private property is anything that I take, I'm taking from all of you, because we should all share. It's a proto-socialist or communist vision, really, of everything must be owned together. Now, against this, Locke says, God, when he gave the world in common to all mankind, commanded man also to labor, and the penury of his condition required it of him. This is the sort of natural reason combined with God's command. That is, you really need to labor, otherwise you won't have anything, and God told you to labor upon the land. And Locke's argument really is that if you don't allow private property, nobody will labor, and there's no point in laboring. Right? No one is going to invest energy, especially in something like agriculture, which is a long-term project, if the person who invests the energy and the efforts isn't able to benefit from that. So allowing people, he talks about the famous tragedy of the commons, something that no one has personal stake in, nobody's going to take care of. So the only way you will get people to invest energy and efforts and resources to make something grow and happen, and so that there'll be more for themselves and through trade for others, is if you allow them to own it. So that's his argument for property. Just to see that. In the end, you look at the section 34 at the end of this page. God gave the world to men in common. But since he gave it to them for their benefit and the greatest conveniences of life they were capable to draw from it, it cannot be supposed that he meant it should always remain common and uncultivated. And a crucial statement is in the middle paragraph. In the second sentence, he says, there was nevertheless left for others because of his enclosure for himself. For he that leaves as much as another can make use of does as good as take nothing at all. Nobody could think himself injured by the drinking of another man, though he took a good draught, who had a whole river of the same water left to quench his thirst. And the case of land and water, where there is enough of both, is perfectly the same. Now this is, I'm emphasizing this because this is crucial to Locke's vision. America had been discovered, but there were great frontiers out there. So the notion that there is land for anyone who will make the effort to go and do something with it, just like there's water without limit. Today, we're not sure about that anymore. Not only down in Atlanta or in Israel, but maybe even, I don't know, how the water supply in New York City. Well, of course, there's also too much water sometimes. Right? We see that. But there is this experience, or there's this vision in Locke, that there's enough. Don't worry. So to our question, are we taking too much? Locke would say, well, in what sense can you ever take too much? You're never going to harm anyone by taking a lot, as much as you can use. You want to till another field, you want to have a whole jar full of spare water, that's okay. There's enough for everyone. So it's very important to emphasize that Locke's vision of freedom, of laissez-faire, of everyone can take as much as he wants, has a crucial ingredient, which is there's so much out there. So whatever I take is not going to take away anything from you or from people across the river or across the ocean, because there's really enough for everyone. So one of the crucial questions today in a world trade organization, in a capitalist society, or maybe a global capitalist society, which in very important ways is built upon the heritage of Locke, one of the crucial questions today is what happens when this premise of his is no longer so certain? And it may well be that there is not enough land, nor even enough water, certainly not clean water or safe water, for everyone. So how does that then play out? Now, Locke never dealt with that because this was a basic assumption for him, that there's so much out there. So one way of trying to deal with the question of are we taking too much, what does it mean to take too much? One of the ways of dealing with that in the Lockean tradition is through saying, okay, we can accept your premise of individualism, of individual freedom and liberty, but you have also recognized this moral religious background of God having granted the land to all humanity in common. You only said that I'm not taking away anything else from my fellow humans by accumulating a lot, because there's enough for them too. But what happens if we can no longer make that assumption? And in a lot of the environmental movement and social justice and global justice movement in the Western liberal tradition, that has been the form of questioning Locke's heritage. Most importantly, I think, in the 20th century, in the works of John Rawls, who wrote his very famous Theory of Justice in 1970, 71, and then much later in 93 published his Law of Nations, which he tried to work out what the implications of a Lockean tradition corrected by Rawls' notions of mutual contract among people, what of all that would apply to contemporary international arena. But What I wish to do with you today, having laid out this background, is to shift to a focus on Jewish sources. And as was mentioned in the introduction, my training has been both in Jewish studies and in moral and political philosophy. I have been cooperating now for, I think, almost 20 years with Michael Walzer and others on a project called the Jewish Political Tradition, which we envision, we actually committed to 4 volumes. 2 of them have been published, and we're trying to finish the 3rd and the 4th now. And in that book, we focus mainly on... What is this? Okay. I thought it was a strong disagreement. I hoped it was support, but I feared it was some commentary. Okay. What we've done in those volumes is really try to collect and collate and set make accessible materials from the Jewish tradition, from the Bible down to the present, relevant to issues of political thought, widely defined, not only in terms of party politics or government or systems of authority, but politics in the sense, in the broad sense of how people live with each other. And it is in the spirit of that enterprise that I wish to share with you some Jewish texts. Now, the main difference, as you'll see in a moment, is that the Jewish discourse, perhaps not surprisingly, is less individualistic than Locke. It assumes cooperation. Now, whether that makes it better or worse is a central issue we're going to have to explore. But let us see. We have here a text from the Babylonian Talmud. That's on page 2 of the handout in Hebrew or Aramaic. This is actually in Hebrew. And the English translation is on the next page. There's a story here about Ben Zoma. There's actually what is probably a more authentic tradition in the Tosefta. But Shama Friedman has shown that Tosefta traditions are even earlier than the Mishnah traditions often, but certainly are more... early or authentic than the Babylonian Talmud. But in this case, because of the commentaries by Rashi and Maharsha, which focus on the text in the Bavli, I thought that was the more important one to focus upon here. Our rabbis taught, one who sees a multitude of Israel should say, blessed is the wise who knows the inscrutable. That's my rather cumbersome English translation of the Hebrew, Baruch Chacham Harazim. Razim is the plural of the Hebrew Raz. Raz is like a mystery or a secret. So I translate it here as the inscrutable. And Rashi, for their minds all differ, like their faces all differ. And Rashi explains that God's wisdom is in knowing the thoughts of so many different people. So the reaction to seeing a multitude of people is to appreciate the difference and the variability, the uniqueness of each of these individuals, and to bless God for his capacity to discern and to know what is in the libo, in the mind of each of these many, many people. Now comes a story about Ben Zoma, standing on a high place upon the Temple Mount, saw a multitude. Okay, so he fulfilled this teaching. He said, blessed be the Baruch Chacham HaRazim, but he added another bracha. The Hebrew is Uvaruch Shebara Kol Eilu Lisham Sheini. Blessed is he who created all these to serve me. Now, there's a big dispute, and you will see this in the text study session to follow. Is Ben Zoma very haughty or arrogant? Imagine that. He sees, I don't know how many, a great multitude at the Temple Mount, tens of thousands, enormous crowds, hundreds of thousands.
Is he calling God there, or is he speaking?
He's thanking God. No, he's...
The B is him?
Yeah. Baruch Shebara Kol Eilu L'Sham Sheini. He's blessing God. Thank you. Thank you, God, for having created all these people to serve me. Isn't it great? I'm not alone. And it's like Robinson Crusoe saying, oh, it's great, I'm not alone. I have all these people to serve me. Well, there's the Talmud connects this to another saying of Ben Zoma. He used to say, how many exertions did Adam HaRishon in Hebrew, but I capital Adam in English, I don't have to write Adam the first. Did Adam undertake until he obtained bread to eat? He plowed, sowed, reaped, collected, threshed, separated the chaff, winnowed, ground, fine sifted, kneaded, baked, and only then ate. Whereas I awake and find all these accomplished before me. I go to the boulangerie, or I have a vendor coming to my door, and there is the bread. How many exertions did Adam undertake until he obtained a garment to wear? He sheared, washed, this is a working of wool, fulled, spun, wove, and only then obtained a garment to wear, whereas I awake and find all these accomplished before me. All nations come eagerly to my doorstep, and I awake and find all these before me. He used to say, what does a good guest say? See how much effort the homeowner undertook on my behalf. See how much meat he brought before me, how much wine he brought before me, how many pastries he brought before me. And all this effort he undertook for my sake alone. But as to a bad guest, what does he say? What effort did this homeowner undertake? I ate one small loaf and one piece of meat and drank one cup of wine. All the effort undertaken by this homeowner was solely for the sake of his wife and children. They had a party and they invited me, you know, but no, nothing much to appreciate here. Well, here is Ben Zoma seeing a multitude, and unlike the first instruction, which just says, wow, you should appreciate God's greatness in creating and in sustaining and in knowing what's in the minds of all this multitude, Ben Zoma's reaction is to say, add to that, oh, how great all these people serve me. So when I said a moment ago that unlike the Lockean heritage, the Jewish heritage is not so individualistic, I said we'll have to see if that's better or worse. And there's something disturbing here when Ben Zoma is saying, well, yes, I recognize my dependence on all these people, and I'm very pleased that they all exist to serve me. So he's not an individualist. He's not like Locke's individual who goes into the forest and encloses some space and raises some beasts and collects his acorns and lives and let others do the same on the adjacent plot. This is certainly someone who realizes that life, as we know it, civilized life is dependent on a lot of cooperation, but his take on the cooperation is all these people are serving me. Now, we don't do that, right? We don't do that. We engage in fair trade. We don't celebrate the fact that we're exploiting others. Well, we don't celebrate it, but an interesting question is, you know, is he just being more honest? Now, a very interesting comment is that by Maharsha, the 16th, 17th century great commentator on the Talmud. The story is that, the tradition is that Maharsha studied the Talmud with his students, you know, many years, and they wrote these commentaries, and they accumulated over the years, and wrote the famous Chidushei Halachot, Chidushei Agadot, printed at the end of most standard editions of the Talmud. This is Maharsha. The Shin is for Shmuel, and Agnon, Shmuel Yosef Agnon, says he harks his family lineage to Maharsha. Shmuel, the same Shmuel. Okay, this is Maharsha. Ben Zoma so. Obviously, other people who engage in labor, oskim b'melacha is the Hebrew, who engage in labor, would only say, blessed be the wise, the standard blessing for seeing a multitude, relating to a great variety of minds and faces as taught above. Ben Zoma, however, who was a scholar and did not engage in labor at all, added a blessing, thanking God for having created so many to serve him. For the various kinds of labor are performed by them in accordance with the variety of minds. That is, there are different inclinations. Some people are inclined to be scholars, and many other people are not inclined to be scholars. I have, you know, these conversations sometimes with people who say to me, what do you do all day? You read books and you write books and you teach. I could never read so much. That's like, they pity me. Well, they say, okay, you know, you're strange people. That's what you do. So Maharsha is saying a lot of people aren't drawn to the scholarly life, and they are, their mindset or their inclinations or their tendencies bring them to do all different other things and engage in labor. This is what he subsequently explains, contrasting his situation to that of Adam, who was alone and had to undertake so many exertions until he obtained bread, whereas I find all these prepared without any exertion, which is by means of this multitude. So, what Maharsha adds crucially to the passage is the characterization of Ben Zoma as a scholar as the grounds for this additional blessing. And that most people would not say this, even though someone who produces garments also goes to the boulangerie and buys bread, right? So he is served by the many people who work to produce the bread. And yet he's at the same time serving them by producing the garments. So that Maharsha thinks, I'm reconstructing his analysis here. He seems to think that's a fair exchange. Now all the people who are part of the pool of the labor force are working for each other. So none of them is in a position or needs to thank God for creating all the others to serve me, because I'm serving the others as well. It is the scholar who, on Maharsha's interesting view, is not contributing anything. And often I'm ashamed to think he's right. That's in my bad moments. And then I try to tell myself that it ain't so. I know we are doing something for society and for contributing whatever we contribute, but Maharsha is quite frank by saying the scholars just take, and they are served by the others, and because of his special position as a scholar, Ben Zoma finds it incumbent upon himself to make special thanks for God. Thank you for creating all these people to serve me. Now again, are any of us today in a position where we are let's say, not symmetrically serving and being served, that is, we're taking more than we're giving, or are we less honest about this with at this point, my questions are rhetorical. I mean, there will be a lot of time for discussion and participation further on. I'm saying this. I mean, you can say, okay, these are these rotten scholars or egotistical scholars who just say, we're happy to be served by everybody, but none of us today is like that. Or is this just being more honest about a situation that many, especially in the richer parts of the world or of society, are... are really in a similar situation, but less quick to admit it and to acknowledge it, and even, surprisingly perhaps, to be thankful to God about it. Now, I chose the Maharsha not only because of this, but also because of the last few lines. So let's have a glimpse of that, where he says, all nations come to serve me. Right? He's commenting on the Talmudic all nations. Since certainly countries are a mutual dependence. Okay, this is already around, 1600s, early 1600s. So there's a notion of international trade, the East India Company, the West India Company. A lot of that is, even though he's in Poland, which we tend to think of as perhaps not centrally involved, that seems not to be the case. And he's saying, yes, nations, the dependence is not only within a local society, it's international. Since certainly countries are in mutual dependence, for whatever is lacking in one may be found in another. The traders transport from wherever they abound to wherever they are lacking. And with regard to that, he said, even what I lack in my location is eagerly brought to my doorstep, available for me to purchase. Okay, so it's not to take for free, it's to purchase. But he actually realizes that his dependence on and being served by a great multitude is not limited to the multitude that he can see out his window in the marketplace in Krakow. but it is a multitude beyond the horizon where the trading ships come from and go to. And he says, actually, there are many things I don't have here, but I wouldn't have here, but for the labors of faraway people. So that's part of his recognition of mutual dependence, celebration of the benefit that he depends, that he derives from this dependence. So, a crucial question for us as we look at this juxtaposition of Locke and the libertarian individualism, capitalism on the one hand, and the much more, I think, realistic worldview as reflected in this page of the Talmud and the comments on it, of mutual dependence, international dependence. Where would we be if each of us was just on our own? We'd be in a very poor state, and we would have almost nothing, and we'd have to work very hard just to continue existing on a subsistence level, maybe not even that. We'd be in a very bad way if we were each of us just on our own. And we really should celebrate and thank God for the complicated mutual dependence and, modern sociologists would say division of labor, which makes it possible for each one to be efficient in his or her enterprise, and then we can share and collaborate. But there is a disturbing undertone here, and that is that of exploitation. I mean, when he is willing to celebrate the complexity, the diversity, and the cooperation among human beings locally and internationally by saying, I bless God for creating all these people to serve me. Now, of course, part of the justificatory story is that I'm a scholar, and, what's left unsaid, but I guess we have to add it, is, and therefore deserve the service of this great multitude. It is somehow appropriate that all these many people are working for me. So there's an honesty, a frankness here in which he's recognizing his dependence on and indeed exploitation of these many people, but he thinks that it's appropriate. I mean, I'm playing a strange game here because exploitation is already pejorative, right? So he wouldn't say exploitation, whatever the... Well, in Hebrew we have nitzul, right? We have vaynatzlu et Mitzrayim, the Jews took something from the Egyptians, but that's supposed to be sort of pay for their long centuries of forced labor. But I don't think Maharshah would say would attribute to Ben Zoma a statement, I'm exploiting these people. But on the other hand, he does say, all these people are serving me. And what's, I think, valuable about the first part of Maharsha's commentary is in his saying very frankly, it's not a two-way street. It's not symmetrical, right? Because he's explaining, why is it Ben Zoma uniquely who feels he should say this while all the others don't? Because he is not part of the labor pool, because he's not making an equal contribution or a symmetrical one, and that is really philosophically and moral philosophy, I think the best working definition of exploitation is when not all dependence constitutes exploitation. Exploitation is where the dependence is not symmetrical, so that one party is getting much more out of the exchange than the other, then we call it exploitation. And what he's saying here is, yes, it is because it's not symmetrical that Ben Zoma is uttering this blessing and describing the situation as all these people serving me. Now, should we be bothered by that about Ben Zoma 2,000 years ago? Or should we be bothered about Maharshah feeling apparently comfortable with saying that's the way scholars live? And is a similar attitude with more or perhaps less intellectual honesty or self-recognition really inherent in a lot of the lifestyles and ways of existence of which we ourselves may be part today? So the question that we now want to explore is, what happened in the Jewish tradition after the Talmud? I mean, of course, Maharshah is after the Talmud, but I used him here as a commentator on the Talmud. So the Talmud has this saying, which has something very valuable in it because it recognizes cooperation and mutual dependence, but also has something problematic in it because it seems to legitimize or even celebrate one-way transfers or exploitation, even on an international scale, as Mao Shah adds crucially. So the challenging or intriguing question is, what happened in post-Talmudic Judaism, in medieval Judaism, early modern Judaism, people, scholars who pored over the Talmud, who encountered this text of Ben Zoma, how did they deal with it? And that is a central part of what we'll be engaging with in our study session.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor Noam. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge, which I should have done before, the presence of Chancellor Arne Eisen, we're very thankful to him for his support, not only of this particular program, but of also of the Boxer Lectureship in general. What we're going to do now is we're going to divide the room. I would say people on this half of the room should go with Rabbi Nina Cardin, and those people on this side of the room should stay in here and study with Professor Eliezer Diamond. So first, I'd like to hear 5 minutes from Professor Diamond about what happened here, and then a little time from Rabbi Cardin about what happened in her group, and then we will ask Professor Zohar to kind of put everything together. Okay, that's a tall order, but hopefully he'll be able to do that. And at the end, then we'll like to leave about 5 minutes for some questions from the floor, and then 1 minute for our student eco rep to tell what are going to be some of the follow-up programs, and then, of course, staying for Mincha afterwards. So. Professor Diamond, please.
So, time is the most irrecoverable resource, and we don't have a lot of it for the session, so I'll be brief. I began by challenging us to go back to the Ben Zoma text and look at the potential tension between the notion that everything is created for me and the notion of the good guest, and trying to use the last part of the good guest as perhaps encouraging a more generous reading of the previous paragraph. In other words, that in the good guest is saying, whatever the reasons are that people are inviting me and doing all of this, because as we spoke about, people have many motives in inviting people and making the big spread. But I choose to regard it as something that is done for me. And so that perhaps that could lead us to a more generous reading of Ben Zoma's statement. And we looked at an interpretation by Ibn Khaviv, which essentially was that interpretation. We very briefly looked at Rambam's diametrically opposed reading. And I'm skipping over some other important conversations that we had because we applied some of this to the present world economy. And then we looked at the story in Baba Kama about the man who removes stones from his field and puts them out into the public domain and tried to understand what the response of the Hasid saying that it was that he was a fool. It doesn't call him evil, he calls him foolish. So we tried to understand what was the foolishness. And we also talked about what implications that story had for how ownership is defined in Jewish thought as opposed, perhaps, to how Locke would see ownership. That Jewish notions of ownership are less absolute and bear, perhaps, more responsibility towards others. That's the five-cent tour.
All right, so I'll also just give a menu of some of the issues that we discussed. We discussed also, coming off of Locke, that Locke had a sense that there was an expansive, infinite world out there with infinite resources and infinite space, and how today And that was that's sort of called like the empty earth model. And today we know that the earth is actually quite small and quite limited and quite finite. And we can just imagine that we can take from it that which we will, make sure that there's therefore enough for everybody else, dump into it that which we will, and not expect to have negative consequences come back and bite us on the bottom. That, in fact, human beings are now, for the first time ever, a geophysical force, that we, in fact, not only is the earth small, but that we have the power to affect not just a piece of the earth, but the entire earth. We as a species do, so we have to be responsible for that. We also did the Bubba Kama text and talked about the refashioning of the sense of private and public ownership and how one defines those two, and talked about perhaps the need to reclaim a greater sense of the commons so that we truly all believe and act upon the fact that we share and own in common natural resources. And then we just talked about, so free-willing conversation, the need to more precisely define exploitation. Because it's not just the consumer that can exploit the producer, it is the producer who can end up exploiting the consumer by the control of commodities if they wish, and that we can both, producer and consumer, wittingly or unwittingly exploit the earth. And unless we understand the earth as a partner in this, a partner without a voice, a partner that needs our voice, there will be an additional component of exploitation that will be devastating. And then we also have to define something we really didn't talk very much about, which is what is enough? When do we have a sense of soma? When do we have a sense of contentment, satisfaction, enoughness? When do I do tzimtzum and still feel full so that you can have enough? When do I contract my consumption and still feel absolutely delighted to make sure that you have enough? How do we define enoughness?
Part of trying to put this together is to connect, as Nina advised me, working on this, you know, a narrative out of these various elements. And because we're honoring here two scholars, I want to say something about the life and maybe the contributions that scholars can or should make. There's this Ben Zoma text, which we began with as a very problematic one. Now, Maimonides, at least in one of the groups, you probably saw this, but I just want to point you to a very poignant formulation, which is on the second half of this book, where you have double pages, the English of Maimonides. This is on page 22. It's marked in the margin as source number 5. Maimonides is talking about the purpose of being. This is a teleological orientation. Everything has a purpose. And what's the purpose of the whole world? And here he says, that is a wise and good-natured man. Good nature is an interesting translation here. It means with good character traits or virtuous. If a person of the human race acquires knowledge and deeds, a man in this category is the ultimate goal for whom the world was created. And for Maimonides, knowledge is crucial. Because you cannot really, he goes on to say, you cannot have really good character without knowledge. And this is really his elitist view. So everybody in the world exists for the sake of the few people, excellent scholars. And he quotes Ben Zoma as support for that. And you can see that on the next page, on the number 24 on the bottom. There now remains one question. You have been told that there is nothing purposeless in divine wisdom. And among all the created things, man is most important, and the purpose of the human species is the attainment of intelligence. If so, why did God create all those people who did not reach wisdom? So for Maimonides, the vast majority of humanity seems superfluous. And he's very happy in response to quote Ben Zoma. All of those other people exist in order to serve the very few in the elite. So here we have, in the life of Jewish scholarship, we have this Talmudic statement. We have Maimonides writing in the 12th century, taking it to the most extreme elitist interpretation. And then we have, in 16th century Tzfat, Rabbi Levi ben Chaviv, offering a completely different interpretation. Eliezer already spelled that out, both in his group and in his recap. That is, he's reading a literary, with a literary eye to the two stories of Ben Zoma. The good guest illuminates the proper attitude. Look just at the top. This is the top of page 37. Ben Zoma's meaning is clear, namely that although he too recognized that in truth God did not create the multitudes for his sake alone, nevertheless, with respect to his obligation towards God, his piety caused him to see it as though they had all been created. So he draws the parallel as if God is the homeowner and he is the guest. You pretend to say that all of this for me, because that's the proper attitude to have, but you realize full well that you don't really believe that everything is for your sake. Going down to the third paragraph in the middle of the page, in conclusion, Ben Zoma had no intention of ascribing to himself any honor or special status. On the contrary, his saying expresses humility and acceptance of the yoke of the kingdom of heaven. He doesn't really believe that everybody was created for him. Everybody was created for each other. We all need each other. But his proper attitude of humility towards God, recognizing the blessing that God did not create me just alone, but created me in a populated world, I have to thank God for what I get from this, just like everybody else should thank God for that benefit of living not alone, but in a populated world full of interdependent people. So this is his take. Now, he's living 400 years after Maimonides. The Maimonides text is not some esoteric or hard to reach text. It's Maimonides' introduction to the Mishnah. Everybody studies that. He's a scholar. Didn't he know it? How could he disregard Maimonides? Now here's the interesting point in terms of the reflective life of the scholar, where he says, in the middle of this paragraph, however, after having written this, when studying Maimonides' introduction, I saw that he cites this statement, Ben Zoma, retaining its plain meaning. That is, he knows full well that the plain meaning is elitist. But he used the other part of the text, the guest narrative, in order to move away from that because he found it repugnant. Right? He says, I can construe this text in a more acceptable way in which it'd be worth emulating Ben Zoma and studying from him rather than shuddering at his elitist exploitism. Now, he says, having written this, I then found Maimonides, who had taken it to the other extreme. Had I recalled these words of Maimonides when I conceived what I wrote, I would perhaps have refrained from writing it. So, it's lucky that I forgot. And that's not what I say. Look at the last paragraph. Since I had not recalled them, as God hid them for me at that point in time, even though I had seen it several times. That is, it was a miracle. Had I remembered Maimonides, I would have, his great authority, you know, I wouldn't have dared to offer this other interpretation. But his now, you must know that for a scholar of his stature to not remember that comment by Maimonides is really unusual. So he's saying, God hid it for me. And he goes on to say, thank God, because that really left me. And then in the end he says, if Maimonides had seen my argument, maybe he would agree, because I have good proof from the text, the guest parable, you know. So in the life of scholarship, this is a beautiful moment to me to see this text, because he's telling how he wouldn't have dared to disagree with Maimonides, but thank God for forgetfulness. And he just wasn't cognizant of that for the moment, and then he was actually able to produce an interpretation, which after the fact he says it's much better, and maybe Maimonides would agree to that. Well, what I want to say in this is that you can see here the work of responsible scholarship. That is, you have a problematic text. Now, it is different. Even in Maimonides' interpretation, it's different from Locke. It is a collectivist perspective. It does recognize the interdependence. But according to the Maimonides move, which he says is maybe the plain meaning or the first reading, it's very problematic. It recognizes the interdependence of humans, but takes it in a morally disturbing direction, allowing, even celebrating, exploitation and elitism. And then he, as a responsible scholar, wants to struggle with that. He says, I don't want to take the text at plain value, at its plain meaning, at its face value, because that's highly disturbing. And if the text is not just a text, but is something that is supposed to lead and inspire, it's not only disturbing, it's actually also harmful. Because if you leave the text with its morally problematic meaning, and people study that text, and Ben Zoma is an exemplary scholar, then his attitude will be internalized and become a source of inspiration, of not so good inspiration for people. So by struggling with the text, this is really his moral duty and his service in saying, maybe unlike Marsha, the scholar too can perform a service if he has this responsibility and he isn't cowed by previous scholarship, even if it's Maimonides, or God helps him not be cowed by it, but he's willing to move forward and assert a contrary explanation. So we have here that move by Ben Chaviv, who really, on that reading, makes the Ben Zoma heritage very helpful to our discourse today, because it's a completely egalitarian notion. We're all in this together. We have to celebrate what we get from each other and thank God for that without thinking that we deserve to take more than we give to others, and without thinking that this interdependence is a license for exploitation. So that's the proper religious attitude that Ben Chaviv's interpretation allows us to see in the Talmudic text and to be part of our take-home message. Finally, I want to have a glimpse at the 18th century text we have here, which is from Salonika. This is a text written in Ladino, translated into Hebrew. I translated some portions into English for today from, I don't know Ladino, so I translated from the Hebrew version by Rabbi Yitzchak Molcho of Salonika. And this is a book which, you know, was published after his death. It was published during his lifetime, but anonymously. And it was politically dangerous, it seems, for him to write some of the things, because he's very provocatively outspoken against prominent people in his generation. Anyway, this chapter is against overconsumption, or what he calls motarot, luxury, against luxury. And he warns us, take care not, this is the last page, take care not to become accustomed to eating expensive foods and wearing high-class clothes. Anyone who eats expensive foods and wears high-class clothes will eventually transgress the entire Torah. That sounds like great hyperbole. But now he tells us how this works. This is the third paragraph. I cannot find comfort seeing the practice of the rich who seek to flaunt their power. The Hebrew is lehit ga'ot, without an object. But I wondered a lot how to translate that. By wearing high-class clothes and eating many expensive foods. Notice, the motivation here is not the enjoyment. Right? It's show-off consumption. They're wearing high-class clothes and eating fancy food, not mainly because they enjoy that. Maybe they also enjoy it, but it's a status thing. Now, it's not that they have a lot of resources. They're very rich, and they therefore permit themselves to do this. He's talking about a different way the psychology is working. They do this for their motivated by the status thing. Since their expenses are great, they engage in extensive trading. Because they have to support that lifestyle. Now, how do they do that? They legally take much money from funds dedicated to orphans and widows and from endowments for scholars. Now, the idea was that rather than have that money sitting idly, you would have merchants take it and investment so that the endowments got a return on their capital. Well, I knew someone would say that, so I didn't have to do that. Now, first of all, what happens to these people? They are troubled and distraught, focused on their trade, making it their main occupation, and their study of Torah a secondary occupation. So before it harms anybody else, it's harming them, because they have to maintain this lifestyle, so they have to be engaged in a lot of trading, and they're distraught because it's high risk, so they can't really focus on what they're really valuable in life. Eventually, their sources dry up. The orphans and widows complain, seeking to collect what's owed to them, but the trader declares bankruptcy. Now he goes on to describe in detail how this happens, and then he says, towards the end of the next to last paragraph, after the parentheses, he says, they sin at the end, for since their situation deteriorates, still they still have money, silver, and gold, and valuable clothes and houses in courtyards, so they could make partial repayments. They make no repayment whatsoever. They deem it permissible to consume the money of orphans and widows and endowments. That is, what they did is they took out a lot of credit, and they need to sustain their high lifestyle, so they're not paying anything back. And he ends up by saying this is outright robbery, because they're really, really consuming things that belong to others. So remember his statement in the beginning, says a very high lifestyle is going to lead you to transgress the whole Torah. So it begins by a problem of virtue and vices. You become accustomed to emphasizing those things in life, even though at first you have the resources, and it's all legal and kosher. So, in the beginning, the main ruin is to your own character, because you're emphasizing the wrong things in life, but then, becoming addicted, as it were, to that, you need, become dependent on this inflow of funds, and are prepared to go to any length, including really usurping anything that is owed to the people with much less good fortune or with no fortune, whom you're really exploiting outright. So the path to outright exploitation and robbery begins with legitimate dealings, which even had a noble purpose to increase the fortune for everybody. You know, to give good returns to the endowments and for the funds of the set aside for the orphans and for the widows, in order that those things should be more and more of them. So it's interesting to see. I just brought here a tiny excerpt of this. If you want, you can. I'm sure the seminary library has more than one copy of Orchot Yosher. There are now two editions of it, and in Hebrew translated. And this really gives a different kind of look. This is 18th century Saloniki, but I guess that there's nothing new under the sun. So there is a warning here that the sense of egalitarian cooperation, which can be found, according to the charitable interpretation of Ben Zoma, in our tradition, the recognition of mutual dependence in an egalitarian way, can become, if people become, I should say, committed to or invested in a high standard of living for personal reasons, for reasons of status, then that can trap us and lead us to exert more and more pressure and exploitation and even robbery towards all those from whom we come to funnel the resources needed to maintain that kind of living. So I think that in order not to end on so dire, my comments on such dire a note, I want to again emphasize what I think the eminent rabbis Boxer showed in their scholarship, and what we should be doing in Jewish learning is working with the texts and not being afraid of earlier interpretations, even by very great authorities, if they lead in problematic directions, and seeking responsibly to find the treasures within Torah to move it in the directions of greater responsibility. Okay, three of us are here. There are a few moments here for... Yes, go ahead.
Very quickly, I think what can summarize, especially what you laid out directly in at the reference, and the question of the whole seminar, is learning how to distinguish between what you want versus what you need. And that will put a terrific rein on you. Not rein permanent, but certainly to rein you in terms of how much water goes down. What do you really need as your basic to be satisfied? Everything else is a bonus.
Well, and just to pick up on the last test that we saw, we just ran. Even if you pursue everything you think you want, you're still not going to be happy because it will take you down to paths you don't want, and it will destroy you. Plus, if you're consuming situationally, if you're consuming only to be in relationship, a higher relationship, someone next to you is always going to be higher. So you're going to always have to go higher. You will never be satisfied. There is no goalpost. The goalpost is always moving. Why would you put yourself in a situation where you can never be satisfied?
That's right. Yes.
Can I ask someone to comment on what extent these values represent in the responsibility of the individual, and to what extent the rabbis expected this to become a societal responsibility? What we're hearing about now is what values an individual should incorporate into his own life. There's obviously larger social questions about relying on individuals to adopt these values as opposed to having them become society enforced by government or some other societal organization.
So, first of all, historically, Jewish communities did have regulations about restricting what we would call conspicuous consumption. Now, two things have to be said. Unfortunate things. First is just a fact, not unfortunately, which is that as often as not, the major motivation for these laws was not to arouse envy among Gentiles in the community, but it's clear that one of the motivations was to limit expenditure in part because it led to this phenomenon of keeping up with the Joneses. If your bar mitzvah is your son's bar mitzvah, you spend $50,000, and I would spend $50,000 too. And to this very day, in tight-knit Jewish communities where there actually is control over the community as a whole, there are communities who limit conspicuous consumption. The second thing, however, is that these regulations were promulgated again and again and again, which makes it very clear that for the most part they weren't observed, or else they wouldn't have actually promulgated. Just want to also throw in here, I told my group I would sneak this in, that the halakhic address, I think, to what we're talking about is simply the 10th commandment of Lo Tachmot. And it is not, I wouldn't say the question is so much figuring out how much is enough, because I think you never figure that out. The thing is, what is your dynamic in life? What is your default position? Is your default position, how do I do the best with what I have? What is my default position? How do I get more? I think that is a crucial decision that people make. And finally, there is a communal obligation to limit consumption. That having been said, in our country, if there is no grassroots attempt to limit ourselves, then there is a certain dishonesty in talking about the malls and the corporations and all of that, which in the end are responding to what we want, to what we say we want. And unless we as individuals at the grassroots level are willing to examine our own patterns of consumption, we can't hold more public or corporate entities, certainly not solely responsible for the problem of overconsumption in our country or in the world.
Takes off the last thing you said here. To a great extent, because we're liberated relative to our historic past in America. We're not under the thumb of the Christian society in very overt ways. And indirectly, this is becoming a great impediment for us because we have become free to model ourselves after an economic system that was created by a Christian worldview. Most of how I see it. And the Christian worldview includes a very dominative as opposed to stewardship notion about man versus nature. It has a different view of the future and the afterlife as opposed to the future of our children, the future generations living here. And it is basically a one-way street. Our economy, under the Christian American model, is driving off a cliff in terms of resources. It is encouraging consumption for its own sake, because we're not thinking about the long-term scarcity of resources. We're thinking about the ability to pump up the economy by mining resources that are not renewable to keep us all happy and comfortable in the short term. And what I'm saying basically is that Judaism as a collective enterprise, if we're really liberated, has to start asserting our role, if not to convert the Christian world, but to assert our values in the Christian world. And to say, if we had not been oppressed for the last 2,000 years, this is how the economy might look. And ask ourselves how we might have modeled it to begin with. And we would not have modeled it after the kind of system we now see America forming. And I think instead of hiding behind the skirt of the American leadership, because they're a majority, and saying we can't change their ways, they're too numerous, we have to stop thinking that way. We have to think, are they wrong or right? If they're wrong, get out from behind the skirt and start telling them politely, but in an informed way, this is how it should be done. Judaism is based on a sustainable model of resources, and we're not living that way. We're making believe our faith is compatibilized either in ethnicity, nationalism, or ritual, and we're not really saying, here's the economic truth of Judaism, put it out there.
Okay, Noam is going to respond to that, and then we're going to hear from Mia Simring, our student rep.
I just want to say in short, you know, of course, you know, I mentioned that I'm a co-editor of a project, The Jewish Political Tradition, and in volume 3 on which we're working now, we have a chapter on taxation and a chapter on welfare. So I don't want to deny that there is sense of talking about a distinctly Jewish tradition, even though it's a tradition with many voices and arguments. But I wouldn't want to end on a note of just saying, you know, the Christians have it wrong and we have it right. Jews have been central in the transmission and flourishing of capitalism from the Middle Ages, at least. And on the other hand, the picture is not so simple in the sense that certainly it's part of the, well, let's say the American system, which causes it to be the fact that an enormous proportion of the grain used throughout the world and shipped for free or near free to countries who need that is produced here. Why is this abundance here? Is that good? Is that good on the long run? But there is an abundance which is produced by this system. I don't want to deny that it has problems. That was part of the exercise, to see the inherent problem. But just to walk away with the very simple we versus them, it would be too easy. So we can argue no end, which is what Jews always do, but that's good in a sense. But I think that if we can walk away realizing that things are more complicated than we thought, and that we need to think more about this and do something about it, then I, for one, and I'm sure my colleagues, will be pleased.
Okay, there's definitely more to be said. We're unfortunately out of time, and I would like to leave Mia with the final word here.
And then we're going to stay for...
Having to do with actions, right. Taking your lead right. For action. Yes.
Okay, first I want to thank the organizers and also our teachers for helping us to think deeply about these very important issues. I'd like to tell you a little bit about what EcoReps, which is a student group, as well in conjunction with the Office of Student Life, is planning for Earth Week, which is going to be April 19th to 23rd. We'll have a series of practical workshops and programs, including an urban composting workshop, a gardening workshop, which will be combined with the launch of a sustainable JTS community garden, and also a sustainable Shabbat dinner will be held. I think we're really hoping that these will be first steps in exemplifying, not only in our learning, but in our actions, the responsibility and stewardship of the earth and our environment, which isn't somewhere out there, but right here. So as Earth Week gets closer, the dates, times, and locations will be made public. And thank you all very much for coming, and I hope that this is just the beginning.